Colonel Evil Reed looks that one.
These thoughts flashed through our minds for a second, and then we turned as one and signalled the vanguard platoon forward at the double to hold the clearing. There was no further action from our challenger. I explained what had happened to Jemadar Chandrabir, and was moving back to place the rest of the company in position on the ridge, signalling for my O group to come forward at the same time, when much chattering and shouting was heard from the far side of the boulders on the edge of the clearing, followed at once by heavy LMG and grenade discharge fire. B Company settled down rapidly on the ridge and started digging in the only fashion the ground would permit, each platoon echelon behind the other. At first, the Japs contented themselves with firing at the forward platoon, 5 platoon, with machine guns and striking the rest of the company with grenade discharge fire. We could hear them shouting and also catch sounds of digging from time to time. I believe our challenger of earlier on had been one of the sentries guarding the main Jap position further up the ridge. On seeing us arrive in the clearing, he challenged us as he was uncertain of our identity, though why he did so in English will always be a mystery. Then, recognising who we were, doubled back to inform his commander of our arrival on the ridge. The digging we could now hear was very probably an enemy subunit taken out of the main position further up the ridge, digging in as close as possible to our position in order to form a close, firm base from which to counterattack us later on. This supposition proved to be correct. Night was approaching fast, so in my radio sit-rep, which I passed personally to Philip Penton, I advised him that we had failed to reach my FUP for the assault on Rana as a result of our current contact along my chosen route to Rana, to the Rana objective, and that there was insufficient daylight now left to make it feasible to bypass the Jap position on the ridge by dropping down below the ridge line to reach Rana across country. The CO instructed me to hold firm where I was and then, at first light, the following morning, to patrol forward against the enemy to find out the extent and strength of his position. Night fell with its usual suddenness, with our positions only dug down to a depth of about 1 foot. The ground was rocky, the men had only their entrenching tools, of course, and mess tins with which to prepare their positions, and the enemy were giving us no peace. With the result that the men in the forward platoon, anyway, had to fight and dig at the same time. A series of attacks were put in on the company perimeter by the Japs between last light and midnight, by which time they must have realised we were here to stay. By about 02:30 hours, most section pits had been deepened to kneeling position cover for most men, and as the enemy attack seemed to have stopped, I ordered that 50% of the company should try to get what sleep they could. The night was cold as we were on quite high ground, some 800 feet. Our haversacks had been left at Gurung, and these contained our blankets, so in the event we got no sleep. I thought I would be clever and utilise the company headquarters' bamboo pole blanket stretcher. So I put this over me, but I found it was so narrow, only about three feet or so in width, that the chill night air got underneath the stretcher blanket. And I got no sleep in the end. And I shared a very nasty night with my soldiers. At last, the long night came to an end. And with first light on 26 February, I sent out a series of Reiki patrols to bring back the information the CO had requested. The patrols reported that the ridge ahead was indeed held by a company of enemy who had well dug in with overhead cover, all of which seemed to be of long standing, with the exception of some fresh positions dug just in front of my forward platoon. These details were reported back to Colonel Panton, who decided that both B and D companies were to pull back as soon as possible so as to allow artillery concentrations to be put down on the Jap company on the ridge, on Rana, on the spur connecting that feature with Pun, and on North Pun itself. After the bombardment, the CO's plan was to launch Dickie Clark's C Company against North Pun. Once North Pun was taken, my B Company was to pass through C Company to hold a ring contour 500 yards to the north and start patrolling up to the edge of the Dokikan Chong, another 500 yards further on. D Company was to be relieved by A Company at their firm base below Rana, and then move forward to occupy the spur joining Rana with Pun. Once again, after the artillery fire had lifted, Dickie Clark took his C Company to drive the Japs off North Pune. This time, C Company was successful, and after hand-to-hand fighting, drove the enemy off the objective. For the second occasion, the Japs used to good effect their practice of strapping their hand grenades to Hakkabakkarai mines. C Company's casualties in this attack were one NCO killed and a further 12 riflemen wounded. The Japs' losses, as in the case of my attack on Gurung, were hard to determine, as they had made every effort to drag away their killed and wounded on withdrawing. Six bodies on North Pune were the only visible enemy casualties to be found. On C Company's reorganization being completed, the other rifle companies took up their new positions as outlined earlier, and battalion headquarters moved toward South Pune. The whole time the battalion's redeployment was taking place, there was much hostile shelling of the Pune area. 27 February was uneventful, with 1410 Baluch of our brigade taking over our responsibilities in the Gurung area. All companies patrolled to their front, seeking contact with the enemy during the course of the day. My 4th platoon was ambushed on the Durkikan Chong, one rifleman being wounded in this engagement. The ambushers then disappeared. Japs continued their shelling of the Pune area and caused the battalion to lose a further 4 men wounded. 28 February saw a further change in the company locations, with A Company relieving D Company on the spur between Rana and Pune, and D Company moving further forward to just south of the Dokikan Chong. C Company replaced my B Company on the ring contour overlooking the Dokikan Chong, and I then took my B Company northeast across the Dokikan Chong, through D Company's new position, and on to the southern end of a prominent ridge leading to point 898. Later in the day, A Company patrolled to Rana and found it unoccupied, leaving two sections there as a standing patrol to guard against the Japs' return. From my new position, I led 4 platoon forward to carry out a detailed recce of point 898 and established that the enemy were holding that feature in company strength and appeared to be well dug in. After carrying out this patrol, I decided to ambush the main ridge track, which led direct from the enemy position to that of my B Company, some 600 yards below. We lay up in a bamboo thicket from before last light, alongside the track and about 40 yards from the Jap Company position. I had Havilah Subhaka's 6th platoon with me for this operation. We could hear very clearly the enemy soldiers talking and digging as they made improvements to their trenches. These noises continued well into the night before ceasing, and so another night passed without sleep. It was eerie lying in the pitch darkness amongst the bamboos, with the wind causing the thickets to creak and groan from time to time, and we were very glad when first light came. We heard the Japs stand to and then stand down. Since they appeared to be making no dawn patrols around their perimeter, or down the track I was ambushing, I withdrew 6th platoon and returned to B Company's main position lower down the ridge. During the morning of 1 March, I arranged for all the battalion's 3-inch mortars to carry out a link shoot on the Jap position on 898. The mortar officer, Captain Roy Owens, chose a base plate position for the mortars in the Dokikan Chong below B Company's position. I climbed a large tree in the centre of my company's position, together with my signaller, and directed the mortar fire onto 898, which was clearly visible from this OP. After the mortar bombardment had finished, I told Haldar Karakbada Tapa, commanding 4th platoon, to patrol forward with his platoon to see if he could find out if the enemy company on 898 had been affected by our bombardment. The patrol moved off, and after about an hour, 3 or 4 bursts of Tommy gun fire were heard from the direction of the Jap position. Then there was silence for some 20 minutes or so, and then came the sound of further firing from the same area, this time just Jap LMG and MMG fire. After that, nothing more was heard, and eventually 4 platoon returned to the company position, all of them with smiling faces. Apparently, the first lot of firing had been a contact with 2 Jap soldiers on the ridge track in the area of the night's ambush position. They had bumped the leading section head-on and had been shot and killed by the section commander, Lansnag Bisram Thapa. After the clash, Havildar Karakbara left the track and probed around the enemy's main position, drawing fire and pinpointing 3 MMG posts. Regarding the effectiveness of the recent mortar shoot, Havildar Karakbada was unable to say whether any enemy casualties had been caused, but he said that, judging from the shrapnel scars he could see on the trees, most of our bombs had appeared to fall on target. Meanwhile, A Company had moved from their position on the spur between Rana and Pune to occupy the former feature previously vacated by the enemy, where they found two Jap bodies killed by D Company on 25 February, and a vacated gun position dug into the hillside in which there are a number of fired 75mm cases. During the night of 1-2 March, the enemy on 898 were harassed by a 25-pounder fire, and on the morning of 2 March, Roy Owens came forward to the OP in my company position to direct another mortar shoot onto the Jap Hill feature. After the shoot, 5 Platoon patrolled forward to 898 and found the enemy still in position, drawing more enemy fire and locating further machine gun posts. There are no changes in the rifle company's locations during this day. Before continuing this story of 32nd Gurkha's part in the coming battle for Tamandu, it is necessary to examine, in outline, certain changes which had become necessary to the core plan. The original plan had been to contain the Japs where met, bypass any strong opposition, and either squeeze out the enemy or surround him wherever he was holding the ground lightly. Such operations would undoubtedly be economical, but might very likely prove a lengthy undertaking. A number of administrative alterations now, however, demanded a more rapid capture of Tamandu to enable 15 Corps plan to go ahead as arranged. It had been the intention to supply 82 West African Division by air during their proposed advance from Dalat to Am. However, successes won by 14 Army on the main front in central Burma and the need for their rapid exploitation called for all available air resources, and it was announced that the supply aircraft supporting 15 Corps would be transferred to the central front in 10 days' time. Major General Stockwell, commanding 82 Division, was therefore forced to change his axis of advance so as to allow his brigades to be supplied by road and water. They were now ordered to cross the Dalat Chong, head for Let Mok on the Tamandu An Road, and from there link up with two Gold Coast Brigade, now approaching this road across country from the south. The whole division was then to launch a frontal assault on An. It was therefore of the utmost importance that Tamandu should be captured and the forward maintenance area there should be established and in effective working order by the time 82 Division reached the road at Let Mok. In addition, an additional reason for the early capture of Tamandu was that two Gold Coast Brigade moving north from Ruewa across country now had many stretcher casualties. These casualties could not be evacuated until the brigade reached the road at Let Mok, and then only if the enemy defences dominating the road around Tamandu had been cleared. The Corps Commander, Lieutenant General Christensen, ordered the capture of Tamandu by 4 March, as already mentioned. 74 Brigade's plan for the Tamandu operation was to contain any Japs holding the long ridge east of the Ruewa-Tamandu road and immediately north of the Ruewa beachhead. Ford the Mechong at low water, secure and repair the bridge over the Chong, which had been destroyed by the RAF to prevent the enemy coming south with heavy equipment to attack the beachhead, and continue with all possible speed to pinch out Tamandu by capturing Point 582, nicknamed Snowden, which dominated that village and its neighbouring ferry. Subsequently, Brigadier Hurst intended to mop up the Tamandu area and exploit northeast through the hills for some 2 miles to an unnamed village on the south bank of the Dalat Chong. This village, later nicknamed Weatherby, seemed from air photos to be an ideal place for a forward maintenance area, and it had been used at one time by the Japanese for that very purpose. Intelligence reports indicated that a weak enemy battalion of 54 Division, plus elements of the divisional machine gun battalion, together with sporting arms, would have to be eliminated before the area could be declared clear. Consequent on Brigadier Hurst's orders for capturing Tamandu, 1410 Baluch passed through 32nd Gurkha's left flank and pushed on against scattered opposition to secure the southern bank of the Mechong during the morning of 2 March. Six oxen bucks now moved forward to the line of the Chong. Recce of the Mi Chong took place during the evening of 2 March, and good fortune favoured the proposed river crossing operation. Low water was due just before first light, and it was the time of spring tides. And as it was the time of spring tides, an exceptionally low ebb could be predicted. Plans were made, therefore, for a crossing on the west or downstream side of the Rhone Bridge, and not at the recognised ford higher up the Chong. At the same time, as a deception measure, 1410 Baluch were to make a faint crossing in the neighbourhood of the ford. In the event, this deception proved very successful, since the enemy directed all his fire and attention onto the area of the ford, whilst the real crossing, early on 3 March by 6 oxen bucks, proceeded almost unmolested. As soon as it was light, the light infantrymen, supported by a troop of Shermans of 19 lancers, started exploiting northwards along the axis of the road, destroying a number of small enemy parties. The Baluchis remained to protect the crossing place, later sending 2 rifle companies north of the Chong. Shortly after first light on 3 March, 3rd Second Gurkhas vacated their positions in the area of 0.898 and the Dokikan Chong, and moved forward to an assembly area in a nullah bed to the east of the Ruiwa Tamandu Road, some 1,500 yards south of the damaged Mi Chong Bridge. The assembly area given to the battalion was only a few hundred yards away from the dusty road. The rifle companies fanned out into their allotted areas in the scrub jungle, where they waited in the stifling heat of the morning for further orders. By this time, 3rd Second Gurkhas had been nominated by Brigadier Hurst to capture 0.582, Snowdon. Shortly after arrival at the assembly area, companies received a warning order from the CO to the effect that once the feature Tobacco, some 5,000 yards north of the battalion's present location, had been secured by 6 oxen bucks supported by armour, 3rd Second Gurkhas would pass through the British battalion, occupy Snowdon, and place a roadblock on the Tamandu Ann Road near the feature Strong. We were to move forward early the following morning, 4 March. Meanwhile, the divisional engineers had been busy, and by nightfall had not only spanned the gaps in the bridge by a suspension trackway made of Japanese wire rope, but had also done a lot of work on both sides of the ford, 200 yards upstream. The enemy on 0.898 were apparently able to watch all this work in progress, but beyond very small attacks, mostly by jitter parties by night, they made no attempt to stop it. The battalion war diary records that a lone Jap sniper made a great nuisance of himself, hiding in the jungle overlooking the Chong Bridge, for 2 days eluding patrols sent to deal with him, and sniping at the working parties in the neighbourhood of the bridge and ford. On finishing his rifle ammunition, the sniper then rushed the bridge, blew himself up on one of his own grenades, at the same time killing or wounding 7 or 8 sappers. Sometime in the afternoon, Colonel Panton called for his O group. Exact details of his initial orders for the attack on Snowdon, except for certain never-to-be-forgotten remarks, do not come easily to mind now, as they were changed several times during the next day as a result of the confused state of fighting by the 6th Oxen Bucks in their advance ahead of us. Because of the subsequent changes in plan, I shall give the CO's orders in outline only. Once 6 Oxen Bucks had taken Tobacco and Pipe, 3rd Second Gurkhas would then pass through Tobacco, take Snowdon, and place the required roadblock on the Ann Road at Strong. Once the keystone position of Snowdon was taken, elements of 82 West African Division would pass through, strike out for Letmork, and there join up with 2 Gold Coast Brigade. The CO went on to stress that, as a result of the importance being placed upon the link-up of the West Africans at Letmork, so as to allow the speedy evacuation of 2 brigades' casualties, which were mounting daily, the Snowdon feature was to be captured regardless of cost. Later events were to show how truly these instructions were obeyed. The CO's plan in outline was to leave the present assembly area at 08:30 the following morning and move north to a forward assembly area south of Tobacco. A Company, Lieutenant Bill Woolcombe, was to secure 0.85 a ring contour 500 yards northeast of Tobacco on the main spur leading up to 5.582 Snowdon. Once 0.85 had been taken, B and D companies would assault simultaneously, B Company moving northeast up the main spur from 0.85 to capture 0.582 Snowdon West, as it was later called, with D Company moving up the line of the Nullah just south of Tobacco and 0.85 to seize the southern spur of Snowdon East. On B Company's capture of Snowdon West having been completed, D Company would continue north to take Snowdon East. After reorganisation and the whole Snowdon feature had been carried out, then C Company would exploit Ford to the Anne Road and block it. The vital question of ammunition state and resupply now requires some examination, as it had a great bearing on the outcome of the fighting which was to take place the following night, the night of 4-5 March. When the CO finished his orders, Major Birtwistle asked what the resupply of hand grenades and 303 ammunition for the Brens and rifles was likely to be after the objectives had been taken. Birtwistle felt that it was tempting Providence to attack a strongly defended feature and hold it against the inevitable counterattacks for a long period, possibly all night, with merely the basic pouch ammunition held by each man. Philip Panton's answer, which deeply disturbed him to give, was to the effect that in the best instance, we are unlikely to get any reserves of ammunition forward of the Mee Chong Bridge much before the evening of 4 March. The CO then went on to stress the great importance under these unsatisfactory circumstances of fire control at section level, and he insisted that all Bren gunners must set their guns for repetition and fire only single rounds unless targets of groups of five or more enemy presented themselves. I cannot recall how much pouch ammunition was held per man in each rifle company, but I do know that B Company soldiers were holding 100 rounds, 50 rounds more than the normal scale, per rifle, 25 filled magazines, 25 rounds per magazine, per Bren gun, 10 magazines, 20 rounds per magazine, per Tommy gun, and 2 hand grenades per officer and man, plus 2 white phosphorus 77 grenades per NCO. These extra rounds per rifleman were held as a direct result of 5 platoon running out of ammunition on the Ponra patrol on 3 July the previous year. Conversely, Bertie Birtwistle remembered that both D and A Company's riflemen were carrying only 50 rounds of ammunition each. The ammunition throughout the Ruiwa and Tamandu fighting left a lot to be desired, particularly in the case of 25-pounder ammunition of the field guns. At first light on 4 March, 3rd Second Gurkhas started crossing the Mee Chong via the semi-repaired bridge, followed by the Divisional Headquarter Battalion, 716 Punjab, who were under command of 74 Brigade for the Tamandu operation. Our advance forward from the Mee Chong was slow, as the rate of advance was dependent on the speed with which 6 oxen bucks with a troop of 19th Lancers were able to clear the enemy from the spurs to the east of the road. The Japs were proving to be stubborn. The sparsely contoured maps were making map reading difficult, thus slowing down the advance considerably. As the day wore on and the time to attack Snowdon kept being put back an hour and then another, the problem of reorganising our position on the objective before last light became more and more difficult. Finally, late in the afternoon, 6 oxen bucks reached Tobacco and Pipe, and 3rd Second Gurkhas moved in behind them just south of Tobacco. Now, as a result of the lateness of the day and the final positions of the rifle companies on the ground, Colonel Philip slightly changed his orders for the attack on Snowdon. Speed was essential if any advantage was to be gained from the few remaining hours of daylight. So with this in mind, the CO put my B Company onto 0.85 to form a firm base for the assault on Snowdon. I found 0.85 clear of enemy, and immediately A and D Companies, under command of Major Birtwistle, passed through my position to climb the spur, to take Snowdon West, to exploit to Snowdon East, and finally to put a roadblock on the Anne Road. Time had now sped by, and there was under an hour of daylight left in which to climb the spur to Snowdon West, attack the feature, exploit Ford, and then reorganise. Major Birtwistle, therefore, led the two companies up the spur much, much faster than the normal dictates of wisdom would have recommended. Navigation with the aid of inaccurate maps was not easy. However, Major Birtwistle reached Snowdon West with 30 to 40 minutes of daylight in hand. The feature was unoccupied, as was Snowdon East. The reason for this will never be made clear. Both features had been held in strength by the enemy until very recently, as the vacated bunkers and slick trenches showed. In fact, leading scouts of A Company reported seeing one or two Japs moving north off Snowdon East when they reached the brow of that feature. Whatever the reason for the Japs' withdrawal, the fact remained that Snowdon had fallen without a shot being fired. Major Birtwistle's primary task had been to hold Snowdon, with the secondary task of blocking the Anne Road. Immediately on arrival, therefore, he dispatched a complete platoon from D Company to move west down the spur from the northwest corner of Snowdon West, where that spur reached the Anne Road some 300 yards away, and to mount a roadblock without further delay. By this time, Major Birtwistle realised that although he thought that Snowdon West, which his force now occupied, was the vital ground, it would be necessary to secure the northern portion of Snowdon East as well, so as to ensure his own protection. In fact, subsequent viewing of the area revealed that Snowdon East was the dominant feature. Major Birtwistle then detailed A Company's 1 platoon, Jemadar Gangabada Lama, for the task of holding Snowdon East. Gangabada took his platoon across the saddle joining Snowdon West with Snowdon East and proceeded to dig in on the northern end of the last-named feature, a conical pimple, which was within the next 24 hours to be seen, of some of the bloodiest fighting experienced by our 3rd Battalion throughout our war against Japan. Major Birtwistle's final action before darkness fell was to dispatch a further section from A Company to recce beyond Jemadar Gangabada's position, northwest along the ridge. This section, in the course of its recce, walked, presumably, into a heavily defended Jap position on Whistle, some 2,200 yards northwest of Snowdon East, and suffered heavy casualties. The section, as far as can be established afterwards, spent the night near the Anne Road to the west of Whistle and Snowdon East, before rejoining their company the following morning, carrying their casualties with them. Thus, by last light, the strength of Major Birtwistle's force on Snowdon West consisted of 3 rifle platoons, plus 2 sections, taking into account the previous casualties from wounds and sickness and the absence of a large leave party. This totaled some 90 men. Orders to dig in as rapidly as possible were issued, again only entrenching tools being available, as although the whole Snowdon feature was dotted with Jap bunkers and trenches, these were all sighted with the aim of repelling attacks from the south and west, whereas Bertie Birtwistle anticipated, and got, attacks from the north and east. The digging commenced and was immediately heard, and individual positions later pinpointed, by the Japs holding Whistle. The ground on both Snowdon features was hard, and positions had only been dug down to a depth of about 1 foot, when Jap lorries were heard moving up the road from the east, from Anne in other words, towards where it wound over the ridge at Strong, to our north. Shortly afterwards, at about 2,000 hours, the first of a series of attacks was launched against one platoon's position. This attack, mounted by 60...